Now, I said today I would first entertain any questions you have on Marx, for this is the last time there will be an opportunity. What is going to happen now is that on Wednesday and Friday, I will sum up the course, and on, well, that's the end of it then. So that this is the last time that there is a chance to ask questions, so that I am open to any questions, especially on Marx. So I'm open now. I'll repeat the question for this, so it gets into the microphone, and that's all. Yes, please.
In your lecture, you mentioned that there's a tension between individualism and determinism in Marx.
The question is, there's a tension between individualism and determinism in Marx, and does it still exist? I don't quite understand the question. Everything exists these days if you've lived long enough. So what is the question exactly? No, I try to make clear it's a question that is, of course, necessarily unresolved, because there's always the human essence, and I'll come back to that in a minute. In the Classless Society, already said last time, it becomes important in the Classless Society. It's important in evaluating art and literature for Marx, and it's important as a kind of basis of why the dialectic works. This kind of human essence to which man strives. So it's no more resolved in Marx than it is in the young Hegel, not in the old Hegel, because Marx, of course, rejects the state. So it's not solved in the state. No, there is an unresolved tension, except as mass movements cannot bear unresolved tensions. So eventually, as you get mass movements of social democracy and Bolshevism or communism, it is resolved. But it is resolved in the sense of determinism and materialism, both in Lenin and in Kautsky. Yes? Because mass movement, you can't have these unresolved tensions. And perhaps if you're looking for the survival of the original Marx, with its unresolved tensions, you have to look to intellectuals. You have to look to George Lukács, Class Consciousness and Society of 1922, a book that was repudiated by the Communist Party. You have to look to the so-called Frankfurt School of Marxist Analysis in Germany, with Adorno and Horkheimer, in the late 1920s and 1930s, people whose relation to the Communist Party was tenuous and almost non-existent. So that I would say you get to something that's fairly typical, that Marx himself and the unresolved tension become what I would call the Marxism of the intellectuals, because for mass movements, you can't have these subtle distinctions and paradoxes. Mass movements must be unambiguous. And because of this tendency with the workers' movement to lack of ambiguity, what you have here is clear, that this dichotomy is always resolved in favor of materialism, because materialism meets two problems. It meets the problem of the working of history. It gives you shelter, it gives you security, it gives you a historical determinism, it integrates you into science. As far as Engels is concerned in the dialectic of nature and so on, it integrates you into science. It therefore gives you a security, and a security in progress. A security that everything will come out all right, and that in the end, existing injustices will vanish, which is, of course, the Social Democratic Party, socialism. And the other is, of course, it solves the problem of the machine gun, the problem which I told you last time. The problem that Marx's model of revolution was antiquated, almost when he put it forward, though he stuck to it in the age of the needle gun and the machine gun. And therefore, you can have a dictatorship of the proletariat before and after. The Marxism is extended into a theory of dictatorship, which it was never, of course, for Marx. So I must answer it this way, yes?
Well,
yes.
In the old Hegel,
it is resolved, but never completely, as you know, in the Prussian state. It is resolved through the Prussian state, which he thought were the best kind of integration man could hope for. But even in Hegel, in the resolution, there is a certain artificiality. Because in reality, of course, the idea, the integration, the dialectic, why should it stop? In other words, the stopping to the dialectic always has something of the artificiality. So it is always basically, if you like, a revolutionary theory, yes? But whether you find the old Hegel artificial or not is a judgment that you must make, yes? Yes, somebody else had the hand up and I didn't see it. Who was it? No, this is about whether in Hegel there is the division of labor. But there is division of labor even referred to, I think, in what you read. Yes?
There is.
Yes, if I remember rightly. there is. But that, David, isn't just a rough reference. In reality, for Hegel, division of labor is important. But it isn't as important as it is for Karl Marx. That is clear. But for Hegel, it is important. It is an important, in fact, for liberals as well, because you mustn't. You must remember something. Always, which I'll come back to in my summary, but which perhaps I should have reminded you more of. We are living in the age of industrialization now in this course, and the question of industrialization you can treat two ways. You can treat it as it's usually treated in history. That is automatically, how many looms, what happened, how many workers, you know, what were the changes of invention and all of this. Yes, the loom, you've heard of the steam engine. Now, all this is important. But for us, what was important, how this industrialization struck people's perceptions. Because it's people's perceptions who lead to action. If let us say, the steam engine or the loom had not struck their perception, it wouldn't matter. But the way they struck their perception is perhaps in two ways. One I want to come back to on Wednesday. That is the new speed of time. The whole change in the concept of time struck them very forcibly, just as it strikes you very forcibly, whether you live in Portage or whether you live in New York. The time is totally different. So it struck you very forcibly. And the second thing that struck them forcibly, David, is the division of labor. Because they suddenly found that there's a new kind of work. Not the work on the land, which is dreary enough, but still you're in contact with nature. There was a kind of idealization about it already. It's very interesting, in the 16th and 17th centuries, people would have said, work of the peasants is alienated work. But by the 19th century, peasants didn't write books, so we don't know what they think at all. But to the people who wrote about peasants, this was, of course, a romantic activity. I've been into this before, yes? So that there was a new kind of labor, industrial labor. And all these people were struck by the nature of industrial labor. Now, it's quite different, because what did they contrast it to? They contrasted it to crafts. They contrasted it to the craftsmen. And they started to idealize the craftsmen as they idealized the peasants. The most famous idealization of the craftsmen, you may know, comes, of course, in the 1860s, which is Richard Wagner's End of the Meistersingers of Nuremberg, where there is that famous passage, don't forget the craftsmen. Germany is based on the craftsmen. Now, in effect, this is another bridge. In effect, for the European right, whether they are fascists or conservatives, and for many liberals, the laboring masses were craftsmen. And therefore, the way to overcome industrial work is to give land to the workers. From this, you get something very important, which is outside our purview now. From this come the first garden cities. Hampstead Garden City in London is the first most industrialized country. You get the garden cities. And you get the idea, of course, that the way to save the laboring problem is capital accumulation, to give the laborer a stake in the factory, not a management stake, but enough stake so he has his own house and his own land. Now, again, this tries to assimilate the laborer into the craftsman. And this is obvious on the European right, but it also goes into liberals. This is quite clear. Now, what struck Marx and Hegel and all of these is how unpalatable this was, this alienated labor, by which they thought of automatic labor, labor without thought. They thought, of course, only of the textile industry. That was the first, labor at the looms. But soon it went beyond labor at the looms. So that you find this alienated labor in all of these theories and how to overcome it. You see what I mean? Now, Hegel thought you overcame it by this process of integration. And Marx thought it was based, of course, on the control of the means of production, and you would overcome it in the classless society. By the way, that's another thing that doesn't rhyme in Marx's classless society. He never actually tells you how meaningless labor becomes meaningful labor. The thing in the classless society is meaningful labor, but he never tells you. He assumes that as in the classless society, freedom, happiness, and rationality will flourish, meaningless labor will become meaningful labor. But how is this going to be? If you sit on a loom or on a mass production, how does it suddenly become more meaningful? This is a program in all socialist countries today. How is it more meaningful whether you turn a screw in East Berlin or in West Berlin? It makes no difference. You know, a screw is a screw, and so on. I mean, it makes no difference. But Marx never tells you, actually, what is meaningful labor, because he kind of assumes he's a Victorian. As I told you before, he has no theory of leisure. So he assumes that there can be meaningful labor. Otherwise, Marxism doesn't make sense. But he never tells you how. You see, because he was an intellectual. These people were not actually working in a factory, you understand. This was all theory, yes, in a way. You see, David, so it's very basic, yes, because surplus value is a product of the division of labor. Everything is. And it goes into personal relations. I might as well say that right here, some of you asked about the family. Does Marx want to abolish the family? Because we've talked so much about sexuality. And I think the answer is pretty clear, that Engels, above all, wrote about the family. But as Engels wrote the family was integrated into the idea of alienated labor for Marx as well. Because the worker, as Marx put it in Das Kapital, the worker has no time for his family. So he's alienated from his family. The family structure is rent apart. And moreover, something else takes its part. As everything is fetishized, And as there are no longer in capitalism what you would call sentiment of beauty, remember what Marx said about the diamond. The diamond is simply a money value. It's no longer an aesthetic. As you have that, similarly, you can't have love in the capitalist family because it's fetishized. What dominates is money, you know? What dominates, if you like, is the struggle for existence, or rather the kind of slavery that a worker is pressed into. So it can't. And the example Marx gives for the fetishization of heterosexual relations, for the fetishization of relations between man and woman is the dowry. You know, women are still sold. Today not, but in Marx's time, of course, every woman had to have a dowry. So as he uses the jewel to illustrate, you know, the fetishization of goods, he uses the dowry to illustrate the fetishization of the relation. There can't be any love because you marry for the dowry. Now, what that really means, however, is something rather important, and I did want to make this clear as we come to the end of Marx. It's not true that either Marx and Engels wanted to abolish the family. The contrary is true. The contrary is true. Marx in The Capital talks about the joys and decencies of family life. What capitalism deprives the worker of is the joys and decency of family life. And everything speaks for the fact that Marx, at any rate, had a kind of romantic view of the family, which in fact he lived. He was a devoted husband, a very devoted father, rather unhappy because his marriages of his daughters, one daughter married, his daughters were very brilliant. Eleanor Averling was very brilliant. But they all made questionable marriages. One married a West Indian, which Marx didn't like. He wasn't entirely free of color prejudice. But actually, that marriage worked out quite well. But the other married Averling, who was really a crook, and Eleanor, the most brilliant daughter, didn't know how to get rid of him, and eventually committed suicide after Marx's own death. And the other daughter also became unstable mentally. It doesn't pay to be children of great people, as you know. I won't even talk about Herzl's children, who were similar, or Freud's children, who were quite unimportant. So what you have there is to be a child of a great person doesn't pay. Be happy if you're children of mediocrities, you have a chance. That seems to be the lesson of all of this. But at any rate, it is still true, probably, Marx was probably a crushing father. I can see how daughters would be crushed by him. So what you have is, however, the decencies of family life. That is to say, again, a paradox. Family life is kept with so many other bourgeois things in the classless society, as far as Marx is concerned, I'm sure. And the whole realm of sexuality is not at all touched by Marx and is not at all touched, really, by Engels' writing. Anyway, the respectabilities, they are extended to the working class. Now, having said this, I must add, of course, that they believed in a kind of romantic idea of marriage, probably in the classless society. And it's Engels who wrote that in bourgeois society, the relationship of men and women is based on the exploitation of women. And there is no doubt that the change in the classless society would be the equal status of women in marriage and in the family. This is more Engels than Marx. Engels, of course, was not married. It's more Engels than Marx. Mrs. Marx didn't have much to say. There's now a book out about her in the DDR trying to prove that Mrs. Marx was a person in her own right, but she was not a person in her own right. talk. But Engels believed in the equality. And from Engels stems the idea that the fight for the equality for women in Europe was a socialist cause and was a cause of socialist parties. And the reason is Engels' idea of exploitation, capitalist exploitation. So in Engels, the bourgeois family existed on, if you like, the fetishism of goods and exploitation. And the classless society would do away with it. But the family as a structure would be kept. And there is therefore in Marx and Engels' own writings, legitimacy to free love. And I'm sure, and I'm quite aware, that many socialists practiced free love, and especially in the Soviet Union for a while after the revolution, free love and that sort of thing. But that's rather a logical outgrowth of the theory than something that Marx and Engels believed. A logical outgrowth of the abolition of bourgeois society, because something comes into it which Marx and Engels didn't know, or if they knew of it, Engels disapproved. Namely, something that's again out of our purview, the revolt of the bourgeois children against their elders, the cultural revolt, the revolt against manners and morals of the end of the 19th century, which was an internal bourgeois affair with the avant-garde and expressionism and all the things socialists disapproved of. But it did have an effect, inasmuch as in the end socialists did take it over as far as the sexual realm is concerned, but only a small minority and not for very long. And so you get here again a paradox, namely that the greatest clinging to bourgeois respectability was in the end in the workers' movement. That in the end, the most petty bourgeois are the socialists, and the most petty bourgeois of all are the communists in their lifestyle. Yes? Now, I realize that Ruth Fischer, the communist leader in Germany, as it used to be said, slept herself through the Communist Party. But Ruth Fischer was really quite an exception. She came very early, and from then on, it was rigid respectability. So what you had, therefore, is a loosening in a way, but in the other way, an emphasis on the family. So that in the sexuality, again, you have this contradiction, if you like, which I do want to stress again for a second, between the permanent basis in Marx and the relativizing of things through the dialectic and through history. There's always, and this is your question, always this incipient conflict between what Marx and Engels took for granted, the Enlightenment, and if you like, bourgeois self-identification, oddly enough, manners and morals. Manners and morals in the Enlightenment, Marx and Engels took for granted. But everything else is relativized. Now, we don't know enough about it, because how much they took manners and morals for granted, you can see in another thing. There is no book, no research, nothing about the left and sexuality. It's a taboo theme. It's not opened. And the theme is taboo because you would let out a can of worms. What you would let out is the intolerance against, let's say, homosexuality, not by Babel. Babel was, in fact, tolerant. But there was an immediate clampdown after Babel. The intolerance for any sexual deviation whatsoever from respectability, the emphasis on norms of respectability. And most on the left don't want to hear that. A lot of things they don't want to hear. It's good for them to hear. They don't want to hear. So it's a taboo. There's no research on this whatsoever. It's completely taboo. And yet it would be a fascinating research, because it would again get you to this whole paradox on what is permanent and what is relativized, and how bourgeois is Marxism. How bourgeois is Marxism? Very, very, very bourgeois from that point of view. so that even revolutionaries were bourgeois. But on the other hand, you must see it in its thing. I mean, you can't really expect Karl Marx and Mrs. Marx in their household with the servants and the daughters and so on suddenly to go hippie. That's not what I mean either. You know, that you couldn't really expect, or even Mr. Engels in thing. But they set a great store on respectability. And that's not just because Marx's illegitimate son was only discovered 10 years ago that he had one. Yes? When he still lived, he became 90. And then, of course, all reporters, tried to interview him. However that might be, and Engels also kept up that facade of respectability, rather libertine life. And above all, in the theory, there is nothing. So that, I think, must be said. Yes, yes, please.
I have kind of a vague sort of confusion about exactly what you mean by when you say that Marx is a man for one season.
Yes, I have to repeat the question. What about Marx being a man for one season and the fact that, what is alive and dead in Marx is really the question. Is he just an example for a misguided authoritarianism, or is there more from Marx? Now, I should first of all, that depends on your judgment, yes? But there is no doubt, I think, that he is a man for one season in this, and I come back to that, yes? That very few today would accept two things. His revolutionary theory, which I've talked about, which is certainly out of date. A spontaneous revolution some would accept, I suppose, but nobody would take it seriously. And second of all, I think he may well be out of date in his idea about human nature. After all, since Marx, there has been Freud and psychoanalysis. We can't just accept the idea that the basis of human nature is freedom, happiness, and rationality, yes? You see what I mean, yeah? That finally what may be out of date is his classless society, in a sense. The end of it, yes? I mean, that's easy to see what is out of date, yes? That is what I meant when I said Marx is a man of one season. But what I think is not at all out of date, and what is, I think, very much alive, is, if you like, Marx's combination between the change in society and consciousness, the change in society and the human essence. Now, I'm not saying this just for my own preference or for any other, a subjective idea. But obviously, it is that is revived. Now, I can give you a history. It's really out of it. First, it was revised by Rosa Luxemburg against Lenin. That is what the controversy between Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin was all about. Yes? And that's what Rosa Luxemburg's death was all about. Because she joined the German Spartacists, so she knew that it was going to fail because she still believed in spontaneous revolution. And so she was killed. She actually died for her belief in the original Marx and her polemic with Lenin. Then it revives again in the 1930s, but more in the Frankfurt School, for example, of Adorno and Horkheimer, in that German school of Marxism. Then it revives again. Of course, I should say it revives in German Marxism, the whole German Marxist revival of the 1920s, which put Germany out ahead. After 1918, France, for a while, is totally unimportant. It's Germany that's out ahead. And the reason Germany and what you call Weimar culture and all the romance about that is ahead is because it becomes a paradigm for a Marxist revival, which passed France and other countries by. And this Marxist revival is again a revival which stresses consciousness. Therefore, it's a revival among intellectuals. These are all revivals about intellectuals. Then you can see how it revived again in Herbert Marcuse. But Herbert Marcuse comes from the Frankfurt School. He transmitted it to an American generation. And then you can see how it revived in the early 60s in a journal when Madison was the center of interesting Marxist theory. From about 60 to 68, Madison was the center of interesting discussions. I should have retired in 68. It's never been so interesting again or so significant. I really mean this. It became the center of all of this for a while with a journal called Studies on the Left and all sorts of interesting people who turned around this journal in Madison. Then this course had 600 and 700 people in it. Then it revived, then it went down. It went down in the riots and it went down in all this violence, obviously. And it is now still alive among intellectuals, and as much as Marx is alive, in two journals. One comes out of here, New German Critique, though you might say, what is Marxist about the New German Critique? And you would raise a very good question, very little. But still, whatever there is in New German Critique, and the other is the main theoretical Marxist journal today, which also has a tie with Madison again, Telos. And both Telos and that. So I would say, and I'm not even talking about Europe, where both in France and Germany this is, in a sense, the Marxist discussion, less in France. France was sort of inundated in orthodoxy. And really, again, I think totally uninteresting in many ways. Inundated in orthodoxy, apart from Sartre and some others, but not Germany now. This is again in the forefront. But it's America where this is most alive among the intellectuals, yes? The European intellectuals had much more recently a sort of trend towards orthodoxy, whether in Germany or otherwise, as is quite clear if you read what they write about modern times. Never read anything German, published in Germany or France with fascism in the title. All it is Bolshevik polemics. What you have therefore here is uninteresting. And the most interesting kind of Marxist discussion is in America. Yeah, but it comes from the 60s, yes? And it comes from the kind of exiles who brought this to America. So that answers your question. Yes. Yes, well, he wanted it to be a workers' movement. Well, that didn't work out because Marx had no, and Engels didn't know, I mean, what mass movements need, yes? I mean, there was no reason why they should have known it. La Salle did know it. And La Salle was unambiguous. But he was a Democrat. He was not a communist. You see what I mean? That's why the German Socialist Party became more LaSallian than Marx, as I've told you before. You see what I mean? Yes, well, nothing works out according to intention. You know. Yes, we have time for a few more.
Is that kind of a criticism of Hegel or a contradiction of Hegel?
No, because Hegel would also say, this is a question, can consciousness only be conscious of existing reality in Marx? And would Hegel have said that too? Yes, yes, Hegel would have said it too, because your consciousness works or is focused or projected upon historical reality, yes? There works within your consciousness the idea of freedom in Hegel, but there works within your consciousness the human essence in Marx. So I don't see a great deal of contradiction here between Marx and Engels' consciousness, but of course it would be Marx and Hegel's consciousness, but it would of course be different in Engels, where your consciousness is subject or imprisoned in the laws of science. Yes? In the laws after Darwin, in the laws of science. That would be different. Yes? But consciousness here is still a sentient and alive thing. I think, by the way, to your question, coming back, that's what attracts intellectuals, of course, to this theory, you see, because in Bolshevism, what role do intellectuals have? None. And there's a very interesting thing I can't help saying is, you see, which people don't really understand when it comes to why were so many first-rate intellectuals attracted to fascism and not, in the end, so many first-rate intellectuals to Bolshevism. The answer is very clear. Fascism gave a place to intellectuals as the kind of master of ceremony. Yes? The poets and the firework marshals of fascism. While in Bolshevism there was no place really for intellectuals because it was all automatically ideated. But in this kind of Marxism there's a lot of place for intellectuals, and so it becomes the Marxism of the intellectuals, or to use an expression which you'll find more often used, left-wing intellectuals. Yes? When people say left-wing intellectuals in a European context, what they mean is intellectuals who have this kind of ideas that we've just talked about. Yeah? Left-wing intellectuals. Yes? Yes, please. It did, yes. Don't make self-consciousness too abstract for Hegel, because your self-consciousness grew as you reappropriated the things that were yours. But that meant that your self-consciousness interacted with reality, because otherwise how would the dialectic be pushed ahead? The dialectic is pushed ahead by an interaction. So what Marx and Hegel's kept was that interaction. Now, it's very typical that that is always the most difficult thing to understand about Hegel and Marx. And that's why it's so easy to, if you like, sunder it, to tear it apart. It's very difficult to understand that you have this subtle interaction and interpenetration. Or what I'm saying is it's very difficult to understand totality. Because you can say what Bolshevism and social democracy forgot was totality. That your personality interacts with reality. That everything is a totality. That's very difficult for people to accept or receive. So it's very easy to tear it asunder in a kind of determinist way. But you mustn't do it. You mustn't do it for Hegel, and you mustn't do it for Marx. Yes. No, no, it isn't. It isn't. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right, because it interacts. Because it interacts. But it wouldn't be for Hegel either. It interacts, though in Marx there is more an emphasis on the other. It's a matter of emphasis. There's more an emphasis on the social reality. There is still that interaction. Because if you didn't have that interaction, why revolution? Why would you resolve? Because you have a human essence. You would rather fight than be a slave. That is a human essence. That makes you make revolution. Yes? That is a presupposition about your human nature. And by the way, to come back to your thing, after Freud, it's no longer, I think, a valid presupposition about human nature. But it was certainly Marx's presupposition. But after Freud, I think you wouldn't say it's a valid presupposition. There are more important things in a person's psyche than that he would rather be a slave. Many people love to be slaves. Well, sexually or otherwise, I guess. Anyhow. So I'm just saying, again, you see, that's a development he could not foresee. And the great thing about the Frankfurt School, as some of you may know, is that it integrated Marxism and psychoanalysis. But Bolshevism rejects psychoanalysis. Until recently, no psychoanalyst was allowed to practice in Russia or in Eastern Europe, or they had to take a different kind of name if they did. Because if you're scientific, you don't need psychoanalysis. So that's very important here, I think. This is not bad, no? I love to ask unanswerable questions. Haven't you gotten me yet? We love to ask unanswerable questions, because it bores me to read questions from you that can be answered. It's not good educationally for you to always have to answer questions you answer, because you come to an idea that you yourself think questions are soluble. I don't want you to come to an idea to think you can answer things or things are soluble. So So the best questions to ask you are always questions that are insoluble. Besides, you see what you have up here in such questions. Yes. Yes, please.
So I'm just wondering, at the end of the lecture, are you going to give us a kind of enlightened answer?
No. I mean, the question is this. The question, let me first say, it's a question for the radio audience. It can't be too long for the radio audience. Yeah. I ask a question. Now, if, as I've said now and then, I admire the Enlightenment, which I do, and if I've said there are all these problems with it, as people wanting a community of affinity and all of this, you see, will I in the end straighten it out? That's your question. And the answer is no, because it cannot be straightened out. And the best that you can do is to fight for ideas of the Enlightenment in a world you know is always going to be unenlightened. That's the best you can do. But let me say something else. If you think that in these last two lectures I am going to give you a personal confession of faith, the answer is no. And I'll tell you why I'm not giving you a personal confession of faith. First of all, I don't think it's important, and I'm important enough. What does it really matter what I think? I had very little influence on the course of events, or we wouldn't be where we are here. that's clear. Second of all, I have already given you enough, and I am a great believer, having studied these things, in the indirect approach. I'm far from teaching you a value-free course, that is clear. is it not? I have definite objectives in view which are outside history, my dear. That must be clear. But I don't believe in approaching them directly. And the same is true in my books and so on. I always claim they're highly scholarly books, but they're all highly political books, really, you know, when you come down to it. And they were meant to. But I think the most effective approach is the indirect. So I am not going to tell you where I stand. Besides, it's very good to get a kind of puzzling reputation. It's much better than to have any other kind of reputation, I think, because it gives you a kind of freedom to be a fool, Narrenfreiheit, we call it in Germany, just as in this society, it's excellent to have a reputation of an eccentric, because you can do what damn you like. So I have all these theories, which I will give you free of charge, as it were. I think you have a pretty good idea of Marx yet, and I wanted to say something the classless society, but I think we've already said enough about the classless society so that I can start next time to sum up the course. But perhaps as in the next two lectures I sum up the course, my dear, you will listen carefully, not only to what I say, but what the political implications are to what I say. There will be some.